Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's episode will be the fourth and final part of our series on Enoch Powell, and we will be talking about the Falklands War. And of course, my co-host for the show will be Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's get into our Greatest Briton for today, Enoch Powell. Once again, we'll start with a summary. Last week, we talked about Enoch Powell's questioning of the wisdom in Britain wasting resources on nuclear weapons when the arms race was between America and the USSR. Greenham Common was mentioned and how the genders appeared to be split on the subject, with mainly women being against nuclear weapons. Immigration came up again and the speed at which whites were being replaced in Britain's cities, with Powell alleging that there was a conspiracy of silence on the subject from the main parties. He also warned of the violence he feared was to come as race riots became a regular occurrence in places where 25 to 50% of all those under 25 were now of immigrant heritage. And finally, he gave a fantastic speech in Parliament where he demolished the idea that it was lack of employment and poverty that was causing the riots, pointing out that the people in question felt alienated because they were alien, and not because they were disadvantaged in any way by the host nation. Is there anything else you want to add to that, Max? Anything else that you want to flesh out?
That seems like a pretty good summary of where we've got to so far.
Okay, well, moving on from there, we'll take a break from Enoch Powell's thoughts on immigration, and we'll have a look at what was happening with the Falklands War. Powell wrote an article for The Times on the 29th of June 1982 in which he said, "The Falklands have brought to the surface of the British mind our latent perception of ourselves as a sea animal. No assault on a landward possession would have evoked the same automatic defiance, tinged with a touch of that self-sufficiency which belongs to all nations." So I think we can see here that he is seeing this Falklands War as being something positive, and it's caused us to remember British sea power and the fact that we used to rule the waves. And he also liked or thought this was a good thing because it also woke us up to the fact that America may not be our greatest ally. "The United States' response was," he said, "very different but just as deep an instinctual reaction. The United States have an almost neurotic sense of vulnerability. Its two coastlines, its two theatres, its two navies are separated by the entire length of the New World. She lives with the nightmare of having one day to fight a decisive sea battle without the benefit of concentration, the perpetual spectre of naval war on two fronts." Powell added, "The Panama Canal from 1914 onwards could never quite exercise that spectre. And it was the position of the Falkland Islands in relation to that route which gave and gives them their significance for the United States above all. The British people have become uneasily aware that their American allies would prefer the Falkland Islands to pass out of Britain's possession into hands which, if not wholly American, might be amenable to American control. In fact, the American struggle to wrest the islands from Britain has only commenced in earnest now that the fighting is over." And Powell then said that there was the Hispanic factor. "If we could gather together all the anxieties for the future, which in Britain cluster around race relations, and then attribute them, translated into Hispanic terms, to the Americans, we would have something of the phobias which haunt the United States and addressed itself to the aftermath of the Falklands campaign." So there's a lot there that he was thinking about that really would not have occurred to me, how America felt about this, and waking up the marine spirit in the British once again. And I don't really remember much from the Falklands, apart from everybody felt very patriotic, and it was miles away over the other side of the world. You probably remember the Falklands campaign a lot better than I do, Max. What are your thoughts on all of this?
It's interesting, the Powell's identifying of the uh, of um, American interests and the fact that the Americans will have felt that they could influence Argentina far more than they could influence us, and that it was in their interest to have bases on the near Cape Horn where they could protect their fleet if it had to pass from one side of the United States from the Pacific side to the Atlantic side and vice versa. And that's a an aspect of the war which didn't have prominence during the time of the war, actually, and it is something which I think has been downplayed, because there was a realization partway through the Falklands War that the Americans weren't being as wholly pro-British as their special relationship, ought to suggest, and that that there were questions being asked as to why we weren't getting the support from the Americans that we thought we ought to have. In fact, we weren't getting the support from the from Europe that we thought we ought to have, because the French carried on selling Exocet missiles to the Argentinians throughout the conflict, and it was those Exocet missiles that caused devastation for a number of our naval ships and caused a lot of deaths and disfigurements of soldiers who were caught in the flames below decks, etc. And so the Falklands War actually was a warning to us, first of all, that we couldn't always rely upon the honest support of the United States of America, and that our special relationship that we thought we had at the end of the Second World War didn't really exist to the extent that we had previously thought it did, and also that the support that we thought we would get from our allies on the continent of Europe, those countries that were members of the European Union, our support from them wasn't as readily forthcoming as we thought it ought to be either. And so it was kind of like a realization on the part of the British public that we did need to still think about standing alone, and we did need to start thinking about how we would fare if we were in a world where we had no allies or no allies of any importance. And I think that had we had any other prime minister at that time other than Margaret Thatcher, then that prime minister would almost certainly have just allowed the Falkland Islands to go, and for the Americans to the Argentinians to take the Falkland Islands, and they wouldn't have had the stomach for the fight. But Margaret Thatcher isn't somebody who is without her faults, or wasn't somebody who was without faults, but the one thing that she did have is that she did have courage, and she did have a determination that has been lacking, and a sense of national pride, and I suppose a sense of national vigor that has been almost entirely lacking in post World War II leaders in this country. And she then made a I can't remember what the date was that she made the speech, but she made a speech in, it probably would have been in early April, where she made it absolutely clear that we were going to retake the Falkland Islands, and that the Falkland Islanders were British, and that we wouldn't desert them. And it was as a result of her determination that the naval task force was dispatched, and that the islands were recaptured.
I've just got a couple of thoughts there. I'm just wondering how it started. I mean, did the Argentinians invade? Did they fire shots on the British, or did they declare war on the British? And I'm also wondering what the nationalist perspective on this was, because, I mean, Argentina, I think they're mainly white, aren't they? Or majority white. And what was the nationalist view at white people going to war against other whites again? So two things there, Max. So how did it start, and what was the nationalist attitude at the time?
Well, it started with a number of statements being made by Argentinian spokespeople in the United Nations and similar organisations, where they laid claim to what they called the Malvinas, which is the Falkland Islands, and they claimed that because of the proximity of those islands to Argentina, that they were rightfully Argentinian, and it was only the British Empire and our imperialism that took those islands away from them, which isn't really true, because what happened during the sort of 1700s and the 1800s is that those islands were used by a range of ships from various different nations who use them as refueling points and restocking points where they were going off hunting whales and things of that sort, or going down to the Antarctic to explore. And that was primarily the way in which they were used. But what happened was that at some point during the course of the history of the Falkland Islands, we set up a permanent settlement on those islands, or several permanent settlements. And those permanent settlements were overwhelmingly peopled by British people. And it became accepted that the Falkland Islands were British islands peopled by overwhelmingly British people, and that was that. But the Argentinians continued to hanker after the Falkland Islands, primarily because the Falkland Islands, if you look at the territorial waters around the Falkland Islands, it gives the Falkland Islanders access to quite substantial fishing grounds, and it also encompasses parts of the seabed where that are ripe for mineral extraction, for drilling for oil and things of that sort. And I think that the Argentinian government have got their eyes on this. But what then happened was that because the Argentinian diplomats had made these speeches in the United Nations, etc., and because nobody really countered them, and the fact that the British government and certainly the Foreign Office had kind of just dismissed these as just being the natterings of a country that had no real intention of retaking the Falkland Islands, there was no formal British response to these claims that had been made. And the Argentinian government interpreted that as us conceding that they were right, and that they had the right to take the Falkland Islands. And so one morning, contingent of Argentinian soldiers landed on the islands, and I don't think it was a particularly large contingent, several thousand men, I think it probably was. They then proceeded to capture Stanley, which is the capital of the Falkland Islands, and the other major ports, and very little resistance was put up, because we had at the time a very small garrison of about 20 men who were stationed there, and they were then faced with an Argentinian force that was many times greater than they were, and so the garrison that was on the islands effectively surrendered without putting up very much of a very much resistance. And I think that was on the 2nd of April in 1982. And it was 3 days later that Margaret Thatcher dispatched the Naval Task Force in order to sail down to the South Atlantic and retake the islands. As far as the war against the Argentinians is concerned, Argentina is a country that's got to some extent, a mixed population, in that there are some communities within Argentina who are entirely English or British. There are some communities within Argentina who were German settlements or settlers, and settlers from other parts of Europe. And there is a very large community within Argentina who are Spanish and of Spanish descent, as well as a number of people who are descended from the original South American Indian tribes that inhabited Argentina before any Europeans got there. But the Falklands War wasn't waged in any way with any kind of racial consciousness. And as far as nationalists were concerned, we were outraged that islands that were almost entirely British in terms of their population had been snatched, and that they'd been snatched in order to for Argentina to snatch the mineral rights and the fishing rights, and also because of the strategic position of them. And that was the basis of our desire that the British government should retake the islands and reassert our ownership of those islands.
So there was a rebirth of patriotism then? There was a real feeling of patriotism, and the whole country was, this is not on. Did the whole country get behind Maggie Thatcher in her bid to take the islands back?
I would say that the vast majority did. I mean, there still were members of the opposition who were saying, oh, this is all going to end in disaster. How can we send a task force? Because I think it was, I can't remember exactly what the distance is, but it's like about 7,000 miles. How can we send a task force 7,000 miles away? You know, that it's going to be militarily impossible for us to retake the islands. There are lots and lots of doubting Thomases who continue to voice those same opinions. Right up to the point where we actually physically invaded the islands. And one of the logistic problems that we had was that there was no base for the Air Force. And so what we had to do was to get Vulcan bombers, who were, even at that point in time, who were fairly sort of elderly. And these Vulcan bombers were then sent off to fly to the Falkland Islands. But en route, they had to be refueled. I think it was at least twice on that journey, and it may possibly have been three times. And what happened was that there was this great logistical exercise that was done, where the islands that we own that are in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, Tristan da Cunha and those kind of islands, the airports on those had supply aircraft fly over and land and wait ready so that they could take off and then meet the Vulcan bombers as they flew down the along the Atlantic, and to refuel them in the air. And as I say, this happened two or three times each journey, and the Vulcan bombers eventually reached the Falkland Islands and dropped their loads on the targets that were there for them to damage. And one of the things they did initially was to drop their bombs on the airfields on the Falkland Islands, so that the Argentinians couldn't use the islands as an airbase and couldn't position fighter planes on there to prevent them from bombing again. But the right up until the Vulcan bombers dropped their first loads and were very successful in the bombing of their targets on the islands, there were these naysayers saying, oh no, it'll be impossible, they won't be able to do it, it's just, you know, physically impossible, and you know, we're trying to be a big nation again when we're just a tiny little nation that's got no ability to do anything. But in fact, our Air Force at the time proved them wrong. And so we bombed the airstrips, and so the Argentinians couldn't use the landing strips on the island. The Argentinians had a fairly sizable naval force, and they had this enormous battleship called the Admiral Belgrano, and this sort of came round and was positioned itself very strategically near the islands in order to block the naval task force as it was coming. And it caused quite a controversy at the time, that a British submarine sank the Admiral Belgrano, and the Argentinians were absolutely outraged because the Belgrano went down so quickly that virtually the entire entire crew perished in the sinking. And I can remember at the time that a phrase became sort of colloquial in the British language, where if anything absolutely bombed, if anything sort of went down like a stone, it was described as having gone down like the Admiral Belgrano, because the Admiral Belgrano sank so quickly. But the point is, we sank the Admiral Belgrano so that the task force was able then to approach the islands. And the upshot of it was that we landed troops at a couple of, primarily two points that were on the opposite side of the main Falkland Island, where Port Stanley is and where Fort William are, or Port William rather. and they consisted of contingents of the second parachute regiment, and also the third parachute regiment, and also 40 commando, 42 commando, 45 commando, also the Welsh Guards and the Scots Guards and the Gurkhas. And they were dropped at two main points. Well, in fact, one point, it was around Port San Carlo. And this was where I think there was one of the British ships was sunk by the Argentinian Air Force using Exocet missiles. But the troops managed to get ashore there and then divided into two groups. And one group, which I think consisted primarily of the Royal Marines, went over the top of the sort of hills in the centre of the island and headed straight towards Stanley and Port William, whilst the other group, which was primarily composed of a mixture of there were some Gurkhas there, but it was primarily the Welsh Guards, the 2nd Parachute Regiment and the 3rd Parachute Regiment, and they headed for Darwin and a place called Goose Green that became very famous because of the Battle of Goose Green, where the main Argentinian force, apart from the force that was guarding Stanley, the other main Argentinian force was around Goose Green. And at Goose Green, they had dug quite sophisticated trench arrangements and had set up machine gun nests that had that were positioned in such a way that any approaching British forces would be caught in a crossfire, in effectively like a killing ground, so that they could be able to cause great damage before the and kill lots of soldiers before they even managed to get to the trenches. And the advancing parachute regiment was initially pinned down, and it was two para that were leading the advance, and two para was led by a chap called Lieutenant Colonel Herbert H. Jones, and they were pinned down by the machine gun fire from the Argentinians, and he very bravely then led the attack upon one of these machine gun post that eventually caused the breakthrough that then enabled two para to then rout all the rest and the other following forces as well. H. Jones unfortunately though lost his life in that attack, and he was posthumously awarded the VC for that. But then having captured Goose Green, the Argentinian spirit of defense was then pretty much broken, because the Argentinians, they had quite a large force at Goose Green. I think probably at least half of their soldiers on the islands were actually in Goose Green, and the attacking British forces were much smaller in number. But we managed to convince the Argentinians that we had a very much larger force, and so the Argentinians then surrendered. And then discovered to their dismay that I think they outnumbered the British forces by something like about 3-1. And so they were, you know, quite shamefaced after that.
That's brilliant. That's a very British way of doing things, isn't it? Especially with all the ones that we've heard of that we've gone through so far with our greatest Britons, particularly the ones where they would make dummies up and pretend that the force was much larger than it actually was. I can't recall the exact ones, but they had lots of fake things have been employed in the people that we've looked at in order to deceive the enemy into thinking that the force was much greater than it was. So I would say that was a great British tradition there of convincing the enemy that we were much bigger than we actually were. And the force that went into Goose Green, would that have been like the Lost Hope or the Last Hope that we've also discussed?
Yes, I think two para would have been in that situation, because I did speak to somebody who served in the parachute regiment and who was there, and they said that they initially thought they had very little hope of being able to overrun the Argentinian positions, but they just stuck to what they stuck to their training effectively, and I think that they actually sent a message to the Argentinians that such was the anger amongst the British troops that if the Argentinians didn't surrender, then they would they would be massacred when they were overrun. And the British troops gave the Argentinians, as I say, the impression that they were much larger in number. And so the Argentinians then felt that they were going to be overrun. And so that's why they surrendered in the way that they did. But a lot of the fighting was done at night. And this was something that was quite unusual. And I think that night vision goggles were something that sort of gave the British troops an advantage. I was told that they used a lot of tracer rounds in their guns so that they could see where they were shooting, because otherwise they were just shooting into the darkness. And so it was a matter of superior tactics and of using intimidation and of convincing the Argentinians that they were much larger in number than they actually were. But the Argentinians, as I say, surrendered, and there were scenes of large numbers of them just sort of dropping their rifles, and the British soldiers collecting these rifles, and there being like huge mounds of discarded rifles and huge mounds of discarded soldiers' helmets, and then all these Argentinians being marched away with their hands in the air. But then the parachute regiment and I think it was the Gurkhas then set off across the island towards Stanley, where they then met up with the Royal Marines that had been going over the top. And then there was the battle to retake Stanley. I don't think the battle to take Stanley was anything like as ferocious as the Goose Green battle was. The islands then fell, and there was a tremendous celebration. And I can remember Margaret Thatcher being very celebratory and being applauded, and everybody in the news media was astounded that we'd actually been able to pull it off and to retake the islands. And so it was a great boost, really, for not specifically for nationalism, but it was a great boost for the British public at large, because, you know, we had been told by our politicians for decades after the Second World War that we were no longer a world power, that we were just this little nation, that we had to be meek and mild, and that we had to accept our absorption into the European Union, and that we, had to be ashamed of ourselves, etc. And then all of a sudden, we were able to do something which was a little short of miraculous, really.
Quite formidable. I mean, if we'd been thinking of ourselves as a spent force, and yet we managed to do that all the way around the other side of the world. I mean, Argentina's right next to the Falkland Islands. It's playing a home game for Argentina, isn't it? And miles away for us. And I can imagine we must have been really annoyed at the Americans. Really annoyed at the Americans. Why didn't you go in there and sort that out for us? Why did we have to send a ship all the way over the other side of the world and bother with all this refueling with the bombers when you've got America right next door, supposedly our greatest ally, the special relationship and all the rest of it? So you can see why Enoch Powell was pleased at that, because that was his view that he had for a long time, was that America was a competitor, not an ally, and that really, I think that really made his view seem rational and sound and to everybody else, and I should imagine the rest of the country actually had that. Well, writing in The Guardian on the 18th of October, Powell asserted that due to the Falklands War, Britain no longer looked upon itself and the world through American spectacles, and the view was more rational and it was more congenial, for after all, it was our own view. He quoted an observation that Americans thought their country was a unique society where God has put together all nationalities, races, and interests of the globe for one purpose, to show the rest of the world how to live. He denounced the manic exaltation of the American illusion and compared it to the American nightmare. He also disliked the American belief that they are authorized, possibly by the deity, to intervene, openly or covertly, in the internal affairs of other countries anywhere in the world. He wanted the UK to dissociate herself from American intervention in the Lebanon, saying, It is not in Britain's self-interest alone that Britain should once again assert her own position. A world in which the American myth and the American nightmare go unchallenged by question or by contradiction is not a world as safe or as peaceable as human reason, prudence, and realism can make it. And I think maybe I got my dislike of Americans from here. Well, I did dislike the American television because it was basically this Jewish comedy, New York comedy, and I really disliked it. And I found out, in the last 10 years, really, that it wasn't Americans, it was American Jews on the television that I disliked. But I wonder if this didn't play into it as well. Obviously, I'm not against Americans now at all. I love my American brothers, and I work with Americans all the time. But I did used to have a very anti-American view. I know that a lot of Germans have a very anti-American view with the American bases there. And it would seem to me that maybe Powell was speaking for a lot of British people at this time in saying that America should have helped Britain in this war, and also looking at America and the way that it behaves and the way that it intervenes around the world and saying, well, Britain should not be involved in that. Britain should not be involved in the war in the Lebanon. We should not be involved in the Middle East and seeing the world through our own spectacles once again, because we had to stand up for ourselves. We had to go there and defend our people. And I should imagine the actual Falkland Islanders, they must have just been so happy to see the British actually get there and rescue them from these Argentinians. We don't often hear much about the British people in the Falklands, but I suspect that they will be, that would have been extremely grateful to see the British turn up and rescue them from the Argentinians. You've got any final thoughts on what happened here and the Falklands War, Max, before we finish?
Well, we still have statements by the Argentinian government that they still have lay claim to the Falkland Islands, and these claims still don't get forthrightly slapped down. And so I think that the Argentinians still look forward to the day when they will be able to retake the islands. I think that as far as a lot of British politicians nowadays are concerned, if the islands were invaded again, then it's unlikely that a British leader might still go back down there again to retake the islands. I think out of the current crop of British leaders that we've got, well, I think people can make their own minds up about whether or not they would be for letting the Argentines take the Falkland Islands or whether they would not. But one of the things that became quite apparent was that it was only once it became apparent that we were going to win the islands back that the Americans then started to intervene again and suggest that there ought to be some kind of discussion between us and the Argentinians in order to assuage the Argentinian disquiet at what we'd done. I think that we perhaps stopped a bit short of where we were, what we could have done, because it would have been nice for us to have caused the Argentinian government that had authorized the invasion of the islands. It would have been nice if we had been able to force that government to resign and be replaced. And I think that what would have done that would have been had we landed and repaired the airfields on the Falklands and then landed Vulcan bombers on the islands. Had we then proceeded to attack Argentina, had we then proceeded to pursue their navy and to sink the rest of their navy ships, had we then bombed the airfields in Argentina and demanded the resignation of the government that had I'm just trying to think of the name of the chap who was in charge. I think it was a General Galtieri was in charge of the Argentinian army. If he had been deposed and disgraced, my apologies if I got the name mixed up and it's somebody else, but that's my recollection. But the point is, we should have, in my view, punished the Argentinians and got them to make a commitment that those islands would remain British forever.
Well, they certainly deserve something like that for waging aggressive war. I would hope that they paid reparations and paid for the damage. Were they made to pay for the damage that they had caused and the costs of all of this? Do you know?
No, I don't think so. I think that was just left to us. But and I think that possibly what stopped us from doing what I suggested was diplomacy and pressure from the Americans, who wanted to keep the Argentinians on side as far as they are concerned.
Well, at least we got our islands back, and the Falklanders were safe. I just want to begin by referring to a comment. We had a comment from Dimitrios Papapostolou last week, and which I encourage people to read, which gives the Argentinian view on the Falklands campaign. And he says that, sadly, after the fall of the administration due to losing to Britain, Argentina followed the road to hell, with Marxism and liberalism getting the upper hand, leading to the ultimate disaster of being enslaved to the IMF. And he was a little bit upset that we weren't giving the Argentinian view. But of course, you know, we may give the Argentinian view on other podcasts at Radio Albion, but this podcast is centred on Britain and the British view and the British nationalist view. So it may not always be in tune with the viewpoint from other parts of the world. But I do encourage people to actually read his comment, because it is very interesting, and it gives the other side of the story, basically. Well, last week we talked about how the Falklands War awoke a patriotic spirit in the Britons that had been dormant since the war, how we started seeing ourselves as an island nation once again, with a foreign policy independent of Europe and America. We also saw that the supposed special friendship between Britain and America really didn't count for much when we had problems of our own that needed attending to, that were right on America's doorstep. And Enoch Powell wanted Britain to disengage entirely from America's program of imposing democracy all around the world, but particularly in Lebanon, where it was happening at the time. He actually remained steadfast against America, really, since the war, I think, was the first time we noticed this this animosity between him and America. Max, have you got any thoughts on that? Do you want to add anything to that before we get into this week's episode?
I think, again, this is another example of history telling us that there's a great need for nationalism on the part of Britain. And the fact that we had, during the Falklands War, we were forced to rely upon ourselves and to ensure that we had the resources available in order to defend our the relics of our empire around the world, which I suppose the Falklands Islands could be regarded as a relic of our former empire. And so not only does modern day history, the history that we're living today, not only does that tell us that nationalism is the way to go, but the events of the past do also.
It is the common sense and logical view to have. Well, in an interview for the Sunday People in December 1988, Powell said the Conservative Party was rejoining Enoch on the European community question, but he repeated his warning of civil war as the consequence of immigration, saying, "I still cannot foresee how a country can be peaceably governed in which the composition of the population is progressively going to change. I am talking about violence on a scale which can only be described as civil war. I cannot see that there can be any other outcome. It would not be a race war, but about people who revolt against being trapped in a situation where they feel at the mercy of a built-in racial majority, whatever its colour." And he claimed that the government had made contingency plans for just such an event. The solution, he claimed, was repatriation on a large scale, and the cost of doing this in welfare payments and pensions was well worth paying. So, 2 points there. He was right about part of the Conservative Party rejoining Enoch on the European community question, and there was always these Tory rebels against the EU, and we ended up with the Brexit referendum. And the second point that he was making here about this problem with immigration and there would be something like a civil war that would eventually occur, and he claims the government had made contingency plans for this. I'm not so sure that they had, it seems that their contingency plans for that was to try and prevent people from warning about this from happening, as if, well, if you don't talk about it, then it doesn't exist. We'll just pretend that this isn't happening by trying to legislate against people from talking about it. But and he was also retiring around about this time as well, sort of retiring from view. Max, you got any thoughts on what Enoch Powell was saying here?
Well, I think Enoch Powell was right, except for just the timing, really. And I think that what's happened is that successive governments since the time that he gave his first warning with the first Rivers of Blood speech, successive governments have invested a great amount of time and money in preventing British people from realising what the ultimate outcome of mass immigration over decades will be. And in doing that, really what they've done is that they've just made the problem worse and made the problem harder to put right at the end of the day, because as the immigrant population here in the UK swells, that then the problem of repatriation therefore becomes a much larger problem and a much more difficult problem to address. And also as the population swells, a point will come, there will be a tipping point at some point in the future where the belief in our government here in this country will be severely shaken, as large numbers of people who've come to live in Britain from other parts of the world will begin to form the critical mass that determines the way in which elections the outcome of elections. And really we spoke about this last week, where one of the features of wars that have taken place, and we're shortly going to be talking about the Iraq war, is that there are now large numbers of people living in this country who came to Britain from Iraq and from the Lebanon and from Syria and from the Balkans, etc., places where we have been involved in waging a war against the governments of their homelands, and where we've turned their homelands into inhospitable places that they've then decided to flee. And so as that proportion of the population of the UK swells in future years to come, then there is going to be this ever-growing proportion of our population that are going to view the British government and the British way of life with increasing scepticism. And as I say, a tipping point is going to be reached at some point in the future where the British people, British people, the indigenous British people, however you want to describe them, the indigenous British people will suddenly realise that they have lost control of their country, and that their country is now in the hands of people who have got very different views and a very different outlook from them.
Our country will be in the hands of our competitors. And that's what we're hoping to avoid. We're hoping to avoid violence. We're hoping to avoid civil war. And we're hoping that a peaceable solution can be arrived at with something like voluntary repatriation, where people are rewarded for going back to their homelands. But getting back to Enoch Powell's life here, we can now move on to the Iraq war. After Iraq invaded Kuwait on the 2nd of August 1990, Powell said that since the UK was not an ally of Kuwait in the formal sense, and because the balance of power in the Middle East had ceased to be a British concern after the end of the British Empire, the UK should not go to war. He said, "Saddam Hussein has a long way to go yet before his troops come storming up the beaches of Kent or Sussex." And on the 21st of October, he wrote, "The world is full of evil men engaged in doing evil things. That does not make us policemen to round them up, nor judges to find them guilty and to sentence them. What is so special about the ruler of Iraq that we suddenly discover that we are to be his jailers and his judges? We as a nation have no interest in the existence or non-existence of Kuwait, or for that matter, Saudi Arabia as an independent state. I sometimes wonder if, when we shed our power, we omitted to shed our arrogance." And I think he's making a good point there. When we had the British Empire, we legitimately had an interest in these places. When we were governing them, when they were part of our protectorate. But since all that has become dissolved. What business is it of ours? And of course, then people will say, well, this is this Zionist influence, isn't it? This is this influence on our politicians by Israel. And a lot of these wars and a lot of these things that we seem to get ourselves involved in appear to be of benefit to them, but not of benefit to us. And as far as I'm aware, I haven't actually come across any mention by Enoch Powell of Israel or Zionism. That appears to have completely missed his attention. But I certainly do agree with what he's saying here about why is it any of our business going into Iraq? And why are we... And again, this is the crux of the issue of why he was against us being so closely allied with America, because he saw this as an American thing. It was America that wanted to go into Iraq, and it was Britain that was just going alongside. Well, what are your thoughts on Enoch Powell's view on the Iraq war here, Max?
Well, I think Enoch Powell was correct. The fact of the matter is that if it is our business, and by it I mean any issue around the world, if it is our business, then we should strive to resolve it in our national interest and not try to resolve it in the interests of some kind of ephemeral sense of international justice. We should resolve any issue in our national interest. The fact of the matter is that at the end of the Second World War, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Palestine, and Iraq and Iran, they were all, and Egypt for that matter, were all British protectorates. So we actually had control of the, something like 70% of the world's oil supply. And out of utter stupidity, governments in the post-war period just allowed all those countries to have their independence. And so we gave away 70% of the world's oil supply at a time when having control of the oil supply was a major means of endowing wealth upon the countries that had that control. And so what we've done is we've given away control of that oil supply to countries that have now been using the wealth that they've created as a result, or that's they've been endowed with as a result of having control of that massive oil supply. They've used that for reasons that suit them, but that don't actually suit us. And the stupidity is, as well, is that instead of dividing the countries that had those oil supplies in a way that served our national interest, we allowed people to sit down with rulers and just draw straight lines across the desert and designate one side of that straight line as being one country and the other side of that straight line as being another country. And what we did was we placed different people. We put different groups of people together who were incompatible and who were then going to fight at some point in the future. And so we had a situation where we've had Sunni and Shiite Muslims both in the same countries, where we've had Kurds and we've had Iraqis in the same country. And we created a mishmash of artificial states across the Middle East that were that were multicultural. In a way that meant that in the future, civil war in those countries would be almost guaranteed. And then we've sat back and we've wondered why the Middle East has been so torn with civil wars ever since the Second World War. And it was created by the stupidity of British politicians who thought that they could divest this nation of its assets in a way that would serve international some sort of international causes and international sensibilities, and in doing so they've just made a complete mess of the whole thing.
Anyway, it boils down to ethnicity once again, doesn't it? If you have different ethnicities within one territory, then you know that's just a recipe for trouble. We see that happening in Syria. I mean, the Kurds weren't even given a country of their own, and they're a massive group. You know, and ever since then, they've been wanting to have Kurdistan, and you've got the PKK, which are a terrorist organization, and the Turks have problems with them, the Syrians have problems with them, the Iraqis have problems with them, and it was all due to, as you say, Max, just putting lines on a map with a ruler, and then at the end of that, we were expected to still go in there and keep the peace anyway, as if it was still our protectorate. I mean, you really couldn't have made a worse mess of things, but that was just a continuation of the war anyway, really. You really couldn't ask for a worse mess in Europe than actually all going to war against one another. We have another war that we come to next. In December 1991, Powell said that whether Yugoslavia dissolves into two states or half a dozen states or does not dissolve at all makes no difference to the safety and well-being of the United Kingdom. The UK's national interests determined that the country should have a foreign policy which befits the sole insular and oceanic state in Europe. During the 1992 general election, Powell spoke for Nicholas Budgeon in his old seat of Wolverhampton South West, and he praised Budgeon for his opposition to the Maastricht Treaty and condemned the rest of the Conservative Party for supporting it. So you've got a few points there. At this time, we had Serbia and Kosovo and all those problems over there. And the UN went in there and NATO went in there, created loads of problems. Britain was a part of that. Why was Britain a part of that? It was nothing whatsoever to do with us. And it was nothing to do with our national interests. It was to do with NATO and the UN and I guess with the EU as well. And we can see here that he is still against the EU, and he is supportive of members of the Conservative Party that were against the EU as well. He did actually end up supporting UKIP. But I think that this was the first time that bombs had actually been dropped in Europe since the Second World War, was when we bombed the hell out of Serbia. And this was really woke a lot of people up to, because, well, really, they started thinking, what the hell is going on? Why are we coming in on the side of the Muslims here instead of on the side of the Christians? Isn't Europe a Christian continent? Didn't it used to be called Christendom? So what are we doing bombing the Christians and aiding the Muslims? And that's been a question that has been asked ever since then. Max, what are your thoughts on the Yugoslav war and what Enoch Powell has to say here?
Well, the Balkans were historically divided into a number of very, very small groups. Then during the period of the Ottoman Empire, the Ottomans spanned both Turkey and large parts of the Middle East, but also then controlled large amounts of land on the Balkans. And their rule of those areas lasted for some time. I can't remember exactly how many years. But during the course of history, there have been various, well, obviously the Ottoman Turks were Muslim, but there have been periods when Greece has expanded and then later contracted and then expanded again and later contracted. There have been periods where the Slavonic countries have expanded, and we've had situations where Poland at one time was much larger than it is today and extended all the way to the Black Sea, and so therefore extended down into the Balkans to some extent. We've had periods where the Ukraine has extended over that same area, and we've had also periods in history where the surplus populations from Germany have travelled and have set up small societies and enclaves and groups in the various countries of the Balkans. And so at the end of the Second World War, the Balkans wasn't an easily dividable area of land. It was an area of land that was peopled by a patchwork of different people of different nationalities, each one of which would have strained under the yoke of previous administrations in order to try to assert their culture and to assert their own ethnic interests. And then at the end of the Second World War, with the Russian army and the communist army under Tito dominating Yugoslavia, Tito then effectively imposed his will upon all the people that were in the old part of Yugoslavia and forced them to live together in a way which just barely kept the peace. And so for decades, there was this sort of seething undercurrent of repressed national interest and ethnic interest in the Ukraine. And then once Tito died, the floodgates opened. And what we had was a situation where there was a tremendous amount of inter-ethnic strife, which, again, was wholly predictable. And it's just a shame that lots of people died in very ghastly ways. And it's a great shame that particularly the Americans decided to join in on, as you say, on the side of the Muslim groups inexplicably, and decided to use their might to bomb the Serbs into submission.
And of course, we had also the leaders. Was it Milosevic and the other one, the other Serbian leader? And they rather spectacularly killed themselves when they were actually in the UN court. They were saying, you know, how can you judge us for fighting back in a defensive war? A similar situation to what happened after the Second World War with Nuremberg. Well, sadly, in late 1992, Powell was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease at the age of 80. But he did continue to have something of a public life. In 1993, on the 25th anniversary of his Rivers of Blood speech, Powell wrote an article for The Times in which he claimed the concentration of the immigrant communities in the inner cities would lead to communalism, which would have grave effects on the electoral system, saying communalism and democracy, as the experience of India demonstrates, are incompatible. So what he's referring here to is the immigrant communities all voting as a bloc. And of course, Tony Blair facilitated this by creating the post of the Mayor of London, and I believe the Mayor of Bristol. And this is why there is a non-white Mayor of London, because it's now 60% non-white and they're able to vote as a communal bloc. And he didn't really see this as happening before, but this would appear to have prevented the outcome of civil war. The fact that they can all vote together and get a non-white representative into power means that they can have that influence that Powell was worried was going to come about through violence and through them taking over in violent ways. And instead, they've been able to manage to take over the system through democratic ways, just through sheer number. I think that's what he's referring to here, Max. Would you agree?
I agree with you completely, yeah.
In May, he spoke for Alan Sked of the Anti-Federalist League, which was actually the forerunner of the United Kingdom Independence Party. So he was really a supporter of UKIP when it was still in its formational mode. And Alan Sked was standing at the Newbury by-election, but Sked went on to lose his deposit at the by-election, polling only 601 votes. That's only 1%. That is a surprise to have Enoch Powell supporting him and then to have him only get 1%. I mean, that's a great change from Enoch Powell in the 60s, when it was only because of him that the Conservative Party were able to win the election. And in the 1990s, Powell would endorse three UKIP candidates in parliamentary elections, and he also turned down two invitations for himself to stand for the party in elections, citing his retirement. And of course, by then he would probably have been succumbing to this Parkinson's disease. On the 16th of May 1994, Powell spoke at the Bruges Group, saying Europe had destroyed one prime minister and will destroy another prime minister yet. And he demanded powers surrendered to the European Court of Justice to be repatriated. In June 1994, he wrote an article for the Daily Mail where he stated that Britain is waking from the nightmare of being a part of the continental bloc to rediscover that these offshore islands belong to the outside world and lie open to its oceans. And I guess we had the Maastricht Treaty and the Schengen Agreement and all this gradual realization that this was a political union and not just a trading bloc, which is how it was put to the British people in the 70s, is that this was just a way that we could trade with Europe and we wouldn't have to pay any taxes and it would just make trading simpler. And Enoch Powell knew all along that it was a loss of sovereignty and it meant that we were part of the equivalent of the USSR, but only the European version of it. So he supported all these attempts to get us to actually leave the EU. He was supporting UKIP there right at the start, as he says here. And he spoke at the Bruges Group, who are still very influential in Brexit. They had a lot of influence with the Conservative Party. I'm not sure if they're actually a part of the Conservative Party, but they did have a lot to say when we were negotiating about actually leaving the EU. It's quite often there would be a representative of the Bruges Group that you would see on the television. Any thoughts on his later years here, Max?
Well, the Bruges Group was a grouping within the Conservative Party. Margaret Thatcher made a famous speech where she said, this lady's not for turning. And I believe that was a speech that she made in Bruges. And as a result of her making that speech, the Bruges Group grew up as from conservative politicians who agreed with her on that particular issue. We could see throughout that entire period there were the various treaties that were being signed subsequent to the Treaty of Rome. And I think what most people didn't realise was that the Treaty of Rome was just a first draft, and then all the subsequent treaties that were issued would then be modifications of the Treaty of Rome and extensions of the Treaty of Rome. And so this then progressed gradually over the decades to the point where the Treaty of Rome effectively is a constitution for a federalist government throughout Europe. And it was kind of when we reached that point that more and more people started to realise that we were being drawn into a federalist state, and that unless we got out, then that was going to be our future. And that as part of a federalist state, that we would be broken up into a number of small regions. And what a lot of people didn't realise is that Northern Ireland was regarded as one of the regions that the UK was going to be broken up into. Scotland was another region. Wales was another region. And that the rest of England, or the rest of the UK, which is comprised of England, was going to be broken up into 9 separate regions. And once that breakup had taken place, then there would be effectively no reason to have a national government. And once there was no reason to have a national government, and the national government was abolished at some subsequent date, then it would then be impossible for the UK in any part to cede from or to withdraw from the European Union without in a constitutional way, effectively. And so it would require some unconstitutional act of rebellion on the part of those parts of Britain that wanted to break away. And I think that there was a realization on the part of an increasingly large number of people that unless we did actually get out of the European Union while we still could, that the only other way out was going to be by fighting a civil war to assert our independence. And that obviously is a kind of a nightmare that nobody really wants to see happen. And luckily, before there was the breakup of Britain into those small regions, and before the British national government could be abolished, David Cameron, out of bravado, decided that it would be a good idea to have a referendum on our continued membership of the European Union. And of course, all the rest of it is history. It's just a great pity that very early on, before we actually joined the European Union, and prior to the first referendum that there was on our membership of the European Union, that the book by Richard Kudinov Kalergi hadn't been distributed across this land. Because had people read his book, Practical Idealism, or Praktischer Idealismus, because it was written in German, had people in this country read that book, then they would have realised that a federal Europe was the end aim of the European Union, and that the progressive racial marginalisation of the indigenous peoples of Europe was an aim of the European Union as well.
It was a central part of the plan, wasn't it? Well, it shows that he was still a part of the Conservative Party, really, that he had been supporting them all this time. If he was speaking at the Bruges group, and it shows that there is a faction of the Conservative Party that does still have nationalist instincts, healthy nationalist instincts. Well, sadly, we will now move on to his passing away. A few hours after his final admission to the hospital, he asked where his lunch was. On being told that he was being fed intravenously, he remarked, "Well, I don't call that much of a lunch." So he managed to keep his sense of humour up right till the last there. And those were actually his last recorded words. On the 8th of February 1998, Powell died, aged 85, at the King Edward VII Hospital for Officers in Westminster, London. Dressed in a brigadier's uniform, his body was buried in his regiment's plot in Warwick Cemetery, Warwickshire, 10 days after a family funeral service at Westminster Abbey and public services at St Margaret's, Westminster, and the Collegiate Church of St Mary, Warwick. So he actually had three separate funerals. Over 1,000 people turned up to Powell's funeral, and during the ceremony, he was hailed as a man of prophecy, political sacrifice, and as a great parliamentarian. During the Mass, Lord Biffin said that Powell's nationalism certainly did not bear the stamp of racial superiority or xenophobia. After his death, many Conservative politicians paid tribute to him, including former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who said, "There will never be anybody else so compelling as Enoch Powell. He was magnetic. Listening to his speeches was an unforgettable privilege. He was one of those rare people who make a difference and whose moral compass led us in the right direction." Other politicians, including his rivals, also paid tribute to him, including former Labour Party leader Tony Blair, who said, "However controversial his views, he was one of the great figures of 20th century British politics, gifted with a brilliant mind. However much we disagreed with many of his views, there was no doubting the strength of his convictions or their sincerity, or his tenacity in pursuing them, regardless of his own political self-interest. He was survived by his widow and two daughters, having led an exemplary life dedicated to his nation, as shown by his intelligence work during the war and his furthering of classical knowledge, his awakening to the importance of ethnicity in the 60s, and putting his career on the line to warn us of the hazards we were creating for ourselves by allowing unrestricted immigration from our former empire, his multiple warnings of future economic problems and why we should be wary of America, fearlessly sticking to his principles on the nuclear issue and for campaigning against joining the EU for the entirety of his time since Britain joined. He really did set a good example of how a British gentleman should behave throughout his life, and he inspired many of our people to speak up when they saw something wrong happening, regardless of what the corrupt establishment may think of them for doing so. And he rightfully appears in our series of Greatest Britons as one of the very best of us, and has been given the longest presentation in the series so far because of it. He was a very, very great man, and I feel very privileged to have learned all about him in this series, Max. I really didn't know that much about him until we started researching his life here, and I'm sure that our listeners will also have learned a lot about him. Have you got any final thoughts on Enoch Powell as we finish up here?
Well, just as we've discussed in the past, you know, he was a person who lived during interesting times, as the Chinese would say, but he was a person who and who was prophetic in his views. My greatest sadness, though, is that he, when he was first expelled from the Conservative Party, that he didn't at that point form his own political party, because I think had he done that, then he would have changed the course of history in this country. And that is his single biggest failing, I think. You know, he was a great man in many, many respects, and I wouldn't want to detract from that. But his single biggest failing was that he didn't capitalise on that greatness. We must all be left wondering why.
He was the greatest Prime Minister that we never had. Thank you very much for listening, and don't forget to tune in again tomorrow for the next greatest Britons in our series, which will be David Livingstone.